Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
And a very good morning to you on this Wednesday, the 20th of July. Welcome to Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, a new HIV vaccine trial involving more than 5,400 volunteers begins in South Africa in November. We talk to the principal investigator.
There were these specific kinds of antibodies that were identified. And so this vaccine that we're testing in South Africa is sort of built upon that.
And the difficulties faced by migrants from Ghana, who went to Libya in search of a better life, only to be forced to return home.
No, I went for money. I did not get money. I only suffered and came back.
Those stories and more on this edition of Africa Link.
Top story.
A major international five-day AIDS conference is now underway in Durban, South Africa. 18,000 delegates have converged on the city to debate progress and setbacks in the struggle to defeat the pandemic, which has claimed 30 million lives over the last 35 years. Antiretroviral drugs are improving the lives of sufferers, and in a few moments we'll be hearing about a major AIDS vaccine trial in South Africa. However, HIV infection rates remain worryingly high and sufferers still face discrimination. From Durban, Subri Govinda reports.
In criminalization now! Stop criminalizing us!
The participants at this session of the International AIDS Conference on Tuesday highlighted the discrimination, isolation and suffering that people afflicted with the AIDS virus face on a daily basis in their lives. They acknowledged that while the provision and availability of antiretroviral drugs and other medical help have brought relief to millions of AIDS sufferers throughout the world, their social isolation is still a major drawback in the fight to completely eradicate the disease. A prominent South African AIDS-affected person and activist, Judge Edwin Cameron, said he was proud of what his and other countries had done to provide relief to AIDS patients. But he said AIDS victims still suffered discrimination.
Governments must deliver on their human rights obligations. Activists and scientists must join struggles for meaningful democracy, for gender equality, and for social justice.
A human rights activist, Sally Shackleton, said the social stigma was affecting sex workers and this must be tackled with urgency if the AIDS virus is to be controlled and brought to an end.
Can we say we are serious when our government, through the police, burns condoms provided by another arm of government? Can we say we are serious when condoms are confiscated from sex workers as evidence of criminal activities?
20-year-old Andy Morobi came forward to admit that he was HIV positive, but had survived because of the activism of many organizations, people, and his family. He was adopted at an early age and provided with support to overcome the disease. He called on the youth and others to join the fight against the disease.
I believe in leading by an example. As a future young leader, I want us to come out of the closet about our HIV status. I know we fear rejection, but let them love us for who we are, not what we have. As Ms. Stefani said, silence equals to death, so thank you.
The young man's public admission came after Hollywood star and UN messenger of peace, Charlize Theron, who also attended the conference, severely criticized people who discriminate against and marginalize those affected with AIDS. A number of scientists and specialists have presented papers at the conference about how the social attitudes of people also affect the fight against the pandemic. One specialist released a report about the cycle of transmission from young women and men older than them. Professor Salim Abdul Karim is concerned about this social phenomenon.
These young women then grow up into older and they pass it to men who infect the next group of young women who grow up. And so we get this cycle. We have to break this cycle. If we do not break this cycle of transmission, we will not be able to slow and stop the HIV epidemic in Africa.
Professor Karim says social issues such as poverty and unemployment must be tackled along with the continuing research against the disease. The International AIDS Conference, which ends on Friday, hopes to reach some agreement on how AIDS transmission and infection could be totally eradicated and 90% of those afflicted could enjoy full treatment within the next 4 years. UNAIDS is working towards an AIDS-free world by 2030.
So, Sobri Govender reporting. Some researchers believe that an effective HIV vaccine is essential if AIDS is to be defeated. But the hunt for a vaccine has been fraught with difficulty. However, in South Africa, later this year, 5,400 volunteers will take part in trials for an experimental vaccine called HVTN702. Larry Curry is the principal investigator on the programme, and I asked him how this experimental vaccine worked.
It builds upon the experience from a vaccine trial that was done in Thailand and reported in late 2009-2010, which had overall about 31% of effectiveness, although it was about 60% in the first year, and then it fell over time. Out of that study, there was a pretty impressive and massive scientific effort to define what were what we call these correlates of protection. And there were these specific kinds of antibodies that were identified, surprising to us that they were not what we call neutralizing antibodies, but they were what we call non-neutralizing antibodies. And so this vaccine that we're testing in South Africa is sort of built upon that. Is specifically designed for the Clade C region of South Africa in a phase one study, which we just presented the data at the meeting, the International AIDS meeting. It produced higher titers of these antibodies than the Thai trial and met all the other milestones that we wanted to make. So we're moving it into what you have very aptly described as HVTN702, which to see if it does work in South Africa.
This is going to be a double-blind trial. In other words, half of the volunteers will be given an inert substance and the other half will get the real drug. Now, let's suppose this drug is seen to be working and is protecting people from HIV. Aren't you then under a moral obligation to give all the volunteers the real drug?
We have contingencies that if we are able to show good effectiveness and durability, that the, you know, what is the normal standard is that one would take the placebo groups and vaccinate them. The trial is run by what we call a data safety monitoring board, an independent group of people who look at the data and make sure that the trial is safe, being well conducted, and they will decree if the trial has to end early or whether to continue it throughout the entire duration of the trial. And they will also, they have ethicists on this, will instruct us who are performing the trial what is the best approach as we move forward if we do have efficacy.
What sort of risks are involved for the volunteers?
Well, the backbone of this, the prototype, the one in Thailand, was a very large study. Over 16,000 people received the vaccine. And so, and we've, the basic backbone and the recombinant proteins have been given to many more thousands of people. So we expect the safety profile to be quite good. In the phase one trial that we have done, the exact vaccine product, which had about 250 people, we saw very mild side effects, all dealing with, you know, aching of the arm for a few hours, some redness of the arm. So the safety profile looks quite excellent.
How far away in terms of years is a successful AIDS vaccine?
This trial, we should have some data by the end of 2019, early 2020. It takes about 2.5 to 3 years to do a trial like this. So start in November of 2016. And so we expect 2019 to be a time in which we would know whether this particular form of an HIV vaccine is effective.
Larry Corrie, principal investigator with HIV Vaccine Trials Network at the AIDS Conference in Durban.
News, analysis and feature reports. All that here on AfricaLink.
At the summit in Kigali, African Union leaders approved a proposal for the deployment of a regional protection force to South Sudan. They wanted to have a more robust mandate than the 12,000-strong UN peacekeeping force, UNMISS, which has faced criticism for failing to stem the latest bloodshed or fully protect civilians during the fighting. My colleague Olli Tangen asked Annette Weber from the German Institute for International and Security Affairs in Berlin whether an AU force would be better placed to keep the peace than the UN peacekeepers.
Well, that's a good question, because what we've seen so far, of course, is the UN Blue Helmet mission that was basically there in the last couple of months, more or less only to protect those refugees or IDPs in their own camps, couldn't engage in the struggle itself. And the question, of course, is that a good idea? The more robust mandate for the AU force right now is basically coming after the clashes started again, or the conflict broke out again last weekend. And the idea is to separate the warring parties in South Sudan with the help of an AU force. I'm not quite sure if we can already say if that's better or worse than the UN mission. I think what we can say is that it will be extremely difficult to deploy these troops, because the president of South Sudan already made clear that he is not accepting a single soldier from outside in his country.
So you don't think that an AU force, even though it's been discussed and even though they've approved it, that it will even be deployed within South Sudan?
No, I think it will, but I think it will be very difficult. You know, unlike in Somalia, where AMISOM was welcomed and called upon by the government of Somalia, and unlike in Central African Republic, where you had the French going in first and then opening that for the AU deployment, if you have a very strict position of the government against a third force coming in, and if this government force itself is quite strong and part of the war, I think the difficulties to actually start a mission of an AU force is not to be compared with what we've seen so far.
How does the mandate of the AU force differ from the mandate of the UN forces already in place?
The AU force will be a force, as far as I can see, that will actively be deployed to stop the fighting. So it's not just to protect civilians, but to intervene in the current armed struggle.
And the African Union has deployed troops to many countries. How successful have these AU forces been in keeping peace and combating insurgents?
I think we have two questions behind the larger issue of, are they successful? A, how do we measure success in asymmetric warfare, as we've seen it in Somalia with Al-Shabaab? Can, let's say, traditional force actually bring peace in this kind of situation? I think that's highly questionable, but we don't have any other force. And the second question is, we don't know how the situation would look like if the forces would have not been deployed.
Part of the politics behind the African Union deployment is, of course, this idea that has been spreading that there should be African solutions to African problems. Do you think that the AU forces are up to the task in many of these deployments?
I would say that I don't see any other force being up to the task for these deployments. I think the deployments are very critical and they're very complicated, and I would say no force is up to the task. So the question is, can we continue thinking or hoping that, for example, jihadist movements can be countered with a traditional army deployment? I think we need to go beyond that. I think we need to think about different options as well. And the same, I would say, is the case in South Sudan, because in South Sudan, we need much more than just a robust deployment of forces. We need a complete change of the political culture.
Annette Weber from the German Institute for International and Security Affairs in Berlin.
Behind the headlines.
Local media in Ghana reported earlier this month that some 200 Ghanaians living in Libya had returned home after experiencing violent attacks and intimidation in the war-torn North African country. The Ghanaians had moved to Libya in search of a better life, and their decision to return was not an isolated one. In Tamale, in northern Ghana, The number of returnees from Libya is now estimated at around 1,000. Local residents, though, are suspicious of them, and the new arrivals have taken to forming self-help groups. Maxwell Souk has the story.
It is late afternoon in Tamale. A group of returnees from Libya is meeting under some trees in a park. They start their weekly gathering with a prayer to thank God for their lives. Among them is Umar Mashoud. Like many of his friends, Umar regrets having migrated to Libya.
I went for money. I did not get money. I only suffered and came back.
Another returnee, Mawia Issa, shares his frustrations.
As I'm talking to you, I regret it very much. My school ended up SSS. I couldn't go anywhere. But if I look at my mates, those who were back home here, I think they've educated themselves well and got jobs doing.
These two are among about 1,000 Libyan returnees living in Tamale. Most of them came home with empty hands. Now they have to live with the stigma of failure, which makes life even harder for them, Umar says.
The community doesn't trust us. The time I came back because of the war, everywhere in the world, people knew they were fighting in Libya. My family do not bother at the idea that, oh, I came with my life. They were rather complaining I came without money. So the stigma is very high. Even if you go to places for job, they don't give you a job. Ask my friends and they will tell you, a Libyan burger, that's all, you are a criminal. So that is why we are together and we are doing small.
According to estimates, northern Ghana is the second biggest region with irregular migration. Families encourage their sons to migrate, hoping to be sent money by them. But those who have been there say this is a costly mistake.
So we want to go to schools to educate the school girls and boys and even lorry station and other places that we can educate them. If we have the support, I think the experience that we have, we can do that.
But the situation is hard because Ghanaian youth still believe that life is much better abroad.
I want to go to outside and further my studies. Simply because in outside countries, as a student, they motivate you with some allowances. But in Ghana, there is nothing like that.
Yeah, I also like to travel when I complete. In Ghana here, when you finish your education, the certificate you'll be holding and someone from outside certificate will be high. So those people will get higher position in terms of jobs than you.
Families are quick to support the children who want to leave, in the hopes of being financially compensated and with no regard for the consequences.
Maxwell Souk reporting. African countries are facing an October deadline to accede to their Economic Partnership Agreements, or EPAs, with the European Union. These deals would give them access to EU markets, but would also expose them to competition from Europe. Cameroon has already signed its EPA, and some activists believe the country is about to be inundated with cheap imports, which will drive local producers out of business. This report by Hilke Fischer is read now by Christina Kripal.
Economist Yvonne Takang is visiting a food factory outside the capital, Yaoundé. Locally manufactured products like those being made here are rare and should become more competitive, she says.
If you visit so many parts of Cameroon today, you realize that most of our food producing industries have been killed because of food products coming from the EU.
The 33-year-old founded the organization Association Citoyenne de Défense des Intérêts Collectifs, or Citizens Association for the Defense of Collective Interests, ACDIC, which campaigns for the rights of local producers. At the local supermarket, Cameroonian products can only be found on the very bottom shelf. The top shelves are full of mainly imported European goods. Takang believes that European Union products will become even more prominent with the upcoming free trade agreement with the EU, called an Economic Partnership Agreement, or EPA. From August onwards, Cameroon will eliminate import taxes on EU products. This is just what chicken farmer Marie-Claire Lockmore is afraid of. 12 years ago, she nearly had to shut down her business. At the time, frozen chicken imports from the EU flooded the country. The meat was so cheap that local farmers simply couldn't compete. Takang and her organization, ACDIC, have been supporting farmers like Lokmo. In the past, their protests stopped the imports. Now, Lokmo is afraid that history might repeat itself.
We've seen this before. And once the frozen chicken enters the market, the small farmers will suffer again.
Back in Yaoundé, Yvonne Takang has organized a stakeholder meeting. This time, journalists and economists are meeting representatives of Cameroon's government and the EU. These meetings are important, says Norbert Belinga, Inspector General at the Cameroon Customs Administration.
Information meetings like these are very welcome because people can voice their concerns and the government can respond and also talk about finding solutions for these concerns.
At the meeting, EU representative Catherine Renner shared information that allayed some concerns of Yvonne Takang's civil society organization.
I was informed about frozen chicken that was apparently spamming the Cameroonian market. So this will never ever happen again because frozen chicken is excluded from liberalization.
Which is nice to know, but according to The Economist, it doesn't solve all the other issues at hand. That's why she's proposing a more radical solution.
If this is not going to be advantageous to us, and if Cameroon is not yet prepared, and if the other countries have not joined, maybe we should put a hold on the implementation of EPAs.
Even if the EU pumps millions of euros into local businesses as promised, experts believe that many small and medium-sized firms still won't be able to compete with European products. They point out that Cameroon was the only Central African country to sign an EPA without any hesitation. Yvonne Takang fears that the agreement will put a brake on Cameroon's much-needed industrialization. That could result in greater poverty and even more dire prospects.
And that report was written by Hilke Fischer.
Opinion.
With a major HIV/AIDS conference now underway in Durban, South Africa, a global study has revealed that some 2.5 million people are still becoming infected with HIV every year. This is happening even though drugs have slashed the death rate and those carrying the virus live longer than ever. What do you think governments or communities need to do to bring down the rate of infection for a disease for which there is still no vaccine or cure? Let us know your thoughts in an email to feedback.africa@dw.com and SMS to country code 49160957595510 or in a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany.
For more about Africa Link, go to dw.com/AfricaLink. Find out about Africa Link's partner stations. Send us your feedback in a text message and sign up for our newsletter. dw.com/AfricaLink.
A reminder of our main stories before we leave you. A new HIV vaccine trial involving more than 5,400 volunteers begins in South Africa in November. We've also been hearing about African Union plans for a regional protection force in South Sudan and about the plight of Ghanaians trying to rebuild their lives after returning from Libya. There we end this edition of Africa Link. Do join us again tomorrow. This is Mark Caldwell in Bonn.